Yep, let's just go.
Great, let's just go. Let's just go. Oh, look. See, Kimberly says it, and it starts. Man, hey, everybody. Scott Rosendahl. This is Make Me Smart, the Tuesday edition. That voice you hear, that is not mine. It is also not Molly Wood. She's off this week because she's a sane human being. Kimberly Adams is in for us all week, helping us out on all of the stuff we need to talk about, which is a lot. Today, we are going to do, I don't even know how to think about this. It's like we're going to triangulate this current moment. We're going to triangulate Black Lives Matter. We're going to triangulate Pride Month, and we're going to triangulate, and I know that we've got four things going on here, Juneteenth. And because there is a moment here that's happening, which we think is worth examination.
Yeah, I mean, I like the fact that you said triangulate, consider, whatever. But so often people talk about these things as a binary, but it's not. Mm. We are human beings who are capable of thinking about lots of things at once. And hopefully we can all do it in a nuanced manner. So in New York on Sunday, thousands of people gathered for the Black Trans Lives Matter rally. And then in Los Angeles, you have this huge gay and queer presence at the All Black Lives Matter March in Hollywood. And across the country, we're seeing these two movements really come together. And all of this is at the same time that there are these big news stories kind of unfolding. We have on Friday, the Trump administration rolled back health care protections for transgender people. Then just yesterday, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in this landmark case, which we talked about, extending workplace protections to LGBTQ folks. And that's being hailed as a huge and surprising victory. And then even today, the Trump administration has this new executive order out on, you know, quote unquote, reforming police. A lot.
which we are going to get to when we start talking about the news. But right now, we've got Keith Boykin on the phone. He is a lawyer. He's a journalist. He's on CNN. He worked in the Clinton administration. He wrote a book back in 1996, actually. So, Keith, I'm dating you. I apologize. Called One More River to Cross, Black and Gay in America. Keith, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Let me ask you, first of all, if you agree with the premise of this conversation, that this is a moment now where a bunch of things are coming together, and it's a moment to try to talk about it.
I definitely think this is a moment. It's unusual to have all these different forces converging at one time, where we have the issue of LGBTQ rights and African-American rights, civil rights, and the rights of all people being discussed at one time because of this convergence. So you're right to point out the Black Trans Matter March that took place in Brooklyn. You're right to point out the L.A. Pride March that was also convened along with the protest against police brutality. Because what's happening is that people are realizing there's sort of a synergy between these two, that there are people who are discovering that there's a connection between all these different things. So I agree, it is a moment.
Well, can you talk a little bit more about people discovering that there's a synergy between that? Because people discovering it emphasizes the fact that some folks have known about this for a long time.
Well, yeah, there are a lot of people who've lived in the intersection of race, gender, sexuality, gender identity, ethnicity, and other different types of aspects of who we are for many, many years, have talked about those intersections. That's one of the things I talked about in my first book, One More River to Cross, for example, Black and Gay in America. But if you are Black and you happen to be a woman or happen to be a person with disabilities or happen to be a person who's LGBTQ or any other aspect of your identity, as Professor Kimberly Crenshaw has written about when she talks about intersectionality, what that means for a lot of people is that you take all these different aspects of your identity with you wherever you go. You can't just be Black. You can't just be a woman. You can't just be queer. You have to be all those things. And sometimes those things get separated. And what's happening now is that people are realizing there's a connection between those things. There's a connection between the different oppressions that people have experienced. A lot of times these various groups have been pitted against one another in a sense of sort of hierarchy of oppression. And instead, what we're seeing now is that people are realizing that it doesn't matter which group was first oppressed or whether they're identically oppressed or which one is more oppressed. The question is, why should any group of people be oppressed? So when we talk about Black Lives Matter, we can't say that Black Lives Matter unless we include Black women's lives. We have to talk about people like Breonna Taylor and Sandra Bland. When we talk about Black Lives Matter, we also have to talk about Black queer lives. So we have to talk about people like Tony Connie McDade, and we have to talk about people like Nina Pop. And so when we talk about all these different issues, there is a connection. And the fact that people are protesting in the streets and have been, and in some cases what people might call rioting or in other cases a rebellion, is a reflection of how the queer movement got started in the first place. If you look back to Stonewall in 1969, it started because Black and Latino drag queens, transgender people, along with LGBTQ people from the community, fought back against police brutality. That's what the Stonewall Rebellion was all about. It was about a fight against police brutality. And now Black people are fighting back against police brutality as well. America's never liked this, never liked to see violence, but it seems to be the only thing that gets people to pay attention. It's what got people to pay attention in 1969 and started a movement. It's what's getting people to pay attention right now.
Has it always been a smooth relationship, these intersections, or have there been tensions? And certainly, you know, recently in Los Angeles there have been. There's been news coverage of that. But I wonder historically whether everything's always been a recognition that fundamentally the cause is the same.
No, it's never really been a smooth transition. You know, if you look back at coalition politics, it always involves a certain amount of distrust and a certain amount of forced trust. Bernice Johnson Reagan from Sweet Honey in the Rock wrote an essay about this in a wonderful book called Homegirls, a Black Feminist Anthology. And she wrote an essay about coalition politics where she talks about coalitions mean you have to get people who don't necessarily see eye to eye with you on every cause, but see eye to eye with you on the larger cause and come together for a specific purpose. That may mean you disagree from time to time and you go back to your own community and you come back to the coalition and you work together. But a coalition is not a womb necessarily where you're going to be supported. It's a place where you come together and you support the larger cause. So I think that's important for people to understand that. As somebody who's both Black and gay, I've experienced racism in the LGBTQ community, and I've experienced homophobia in the Black community. And it's not pleasant from either side. And a lot of other people who are in my position, Black, queer, or Black, same gender loving people, have that same experience. So we just want to be our full selves. We don't want to have to take one of our identities away from a particular space because we are not welcome in that space. That's what true liberation means. So Dr. King said, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere.
So what makes this moment different then? Because you've just laid out a very clear history of sort of the ebbs and flows of these groups working together or not, and rightfully pointing out sort of the homophobia that has existed traditionally in some parts of the Black community. What makes this moment different?
I think what's different about this moment is that people are realizing that they're fed up, and they're willing to say they're fed up, and they're realizing they have power. And that's unusual. I mean, in the past, people have had protest movements. If you go back to Occupy Wall Street or even the beginning of Black Lives Matter or anti-war protests, and they would come for a while and they'd fizzle out after a certain amount of time. Part of that was because people had to go back to their jobs and their schools and things like that. Now we have a pandemic that is still going on, which has forced people to stay at home and not to go to work or not to go to school. So that means that they have more time on their hands. And they're also realizing that when they push back, that there is change. They're realizing that if you push back against the policing in Minneapolis, the Minneapolis City Council responds. If you push back against the police department in Atlanta, the Atlanta police chief resigns. If you push back against the police account of what took place with a white man, 75 years old, being pushed by the police, the Buffalo police respond. In the Buffalo police respond in a negative way, but you see that whatever action there is a response, there's a counteraction. I think it's just a frustration. You know, we've gone through the coronavirus, we're going through the protests, we've gone through all these different things, and we're seeing that there is a possibility to make change now. And I think this is perhaps the best opportunity we've had to move forward in quite some time because the dialogue is changing. So a lot of people who are in the middle, so to speak, or moderate lane of Democratic politics or progressive politics feel uncomfortable with some of the language that's going on. For example, defund the police or abolish the police. Those are very controversial ideas for a lot of people. But if you go back in time 20 years ago, the idea of marriage equality was a controversial idea. And it took the fact that people pushed for marriage equality to get the Democratic establishment to even accept the idea of civil unions as being sort of a fallback or a failsafe. And then by getting marriage equality, it made it easier for the Supreme Court just this week to issue a decision to allow equal treatment in employment discrimination. So I think what the groups are learning is that you can't just push for half of what you want. You have to push for everything you want, or otherwise you'll be compromising and negotiating against yourself.
This pushing that's happening is it, against whom are you pushing? Are you pushing at the national level? Is this a state and local issue, as it is for Black Lives Matter with police brutality and that kind of thing? I mean, there's obviously there's a lot of moving parts, right?
I think it's pushing at every level, particularly when we're dealing with policing, yeah. Because policing is not typically a national issue. It's a state and local issue. State and local governments control the predominant resources in terms of policing. And people are pushing for their police chiefs and local mayors and city councils to be more accountable to the public. They're pushing for their state chief executives and governors to reconsider the way that they deploy the National Guard forces. They're pushing for the president and the White House to reconsider the use of tear gas against protesters, or for Congress to reconsider mm-hmm. legislation that might move forward on policing reform. So I think it's happening at all three levels. It's not just happening at one level. But there's an old saying in the environmental movement, which is that if you think globally and act locally, I think people are doing mm-hmm. this. They're reimagining the world. What kind of world do we want to live in? How do we create that? You do that by taking local action or local steps to change things to get to that world.
How sustainable do you think this current coalition is? Because right now, unlike a lot of previous moments where there are a lot more white people out in the streets protesting with black people, there is this synergy that we're talking about between sort of the Black Lives Matter movement and a lot of these pride events. I'm curious where you see this going in terms of next steps and this coalition.
Well, it's important just to step back a bit in history to understand that the black civil rights movement was always helped by black queer people. People like James Baldwin, who was a luminary in the movement and also a black gay man, or Lorraine Hansberry, who wrote A Raisin in the Sun, who was a black lesbian woman, or Bayard Rustin, who was a black gay man who organized Dr. King's famous March on Washington speech, in March on Washington in 1963, where he gave his I Have a Dream speech. And that history continued even into the Black Lives Matter movement. Two of the three key principal organizers or founders of the Black Lives Matter movement were black queer women. So automatically from the beginning, there's an intersectionality that takes place, the people who are understanding the need to have these sort of overlapping conversations that we're engaging in. I don't expect that to change. I think that people have gotten to the point where that you can't put that genie back in the bottle. Whether or not the coalition is a comfortable one is a different question, because there will be points where a group's interests may not seem like they align. But I don't think you can go back and say, well, we're only going to focus on black people. We're only going to focus on queer people. I mean, even the LGBTQ movement had this problem a few years ago when there was a tendency to focus only on equality for sexual orientation. They were willing to sort of write off gender identity and forget about trans inclusion because it wasn't politically feasible, people thought. But one of the things that we're learning now, again, is that if you push for everything you want, it makes it a lot easier. It's also the reason why I say to all the other people who are in politics that you shouldn't be concerned or afraid of these conversations, because the fact that people are pushing for what you may consider to be extreme or radical proposals makes it easier for you to push for a proposal that you couldn't have even imagined two or three years ago, or even two or three months ago, that would have been radical then, but now it might be considered moderate. So I think it gives opportunity for people who really want progressive change to move forward and to work hand in hand with people on the inside and people on the outside.
This is kind of a mushy question, but do you think this time is different? Are you more hopeful now?
Well, that's a tough question. You know, in some ways I am hopeful. I'm hopeful a little bit because I think that I see people in the community, young people, stepping up and speaking out. And, you know, for a long time, people have been very critical of millennials and Gen Z and all the people who they said weren't really standing up and doing enough. These people are standing up. I've been out in some of these protests in New York City. I've been covering them. I was arrested with some of the protesters a week or two ago, actually. And I had a chance to spend time in jail with these protesters and see what exactly they're fighting for. And these people are determined. They don't mind going to jail. I saw just a few days ago, there was a young man on television here in New York who said he'd been protesting 14 days in a row and arrested 9 times. Mm-hmm. And he had no plans to stop. He was going to go to work every day and come back and go out back to the protest lines. That's incredible. And I think that is different. We haven't seen anything like that in my lifetime. Certainly, if you go back to the civil rights movement era, then we saw examples of that behavior. But this is unprecedented for the new age. And I think it's a hopeful sign.
Keith Boykin is a CNN commentator and author. He has a new book coming out next year called Race Against Time, Politics of a Darkening America. Keith, thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
For sure.
I'll certainly be grabbing it. Can't wait to
Yeah, that was good. That was good stuff. There's just so much going on right now.
Yeah, but I really love the historical context that he shared about that. You know, as we said at the top, this is new to a lot of people, but this overlap has been forever in this movement. And it's just sort of the ebbs and flows of it and people sort of coming to terms, because I mean, I certainly, you know, can speak to within my own Black American family, when my uncle came out or when my brother came out, it was not a good look at all. And so,
Well, I was just gonna, so is this one of your Uncle David's, right?
Yes, it's one of my Uncle David's.
Okay. So he's not a young man now. How old was he when he came out?
Formally, in the 90s. So let's see, he's in his 60s. Yeah. So I guess he was in like his late 30s or something.
Right.
But, you know, my family ostracized him. And we've gone from that to now everybody loves both Uncle David's.
Right. Holy cow.
Well, it seems like we need a break. I believe that's how y'all do this. But we want to do a call out specifically. Look, I'm learning. This is new for
me. You're one of us. Come on. You're on the team.
I know.
It's not you. It's we.
It's we. Okay, but we need to do a call out for our listeners who identified with these issues and ideas. So tell us what you think about this moment, these protests, this change that we're witnessing. We want to hear from you. So record yourself in a voice memo and send it to makemesmart@marketplace.org, and we'll be right back.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
Get one of the most successful broadcasts in television history on your schedule with the 60 Minutes podcast. Hard-hitting investigative reports, news, and culture maker interviews, and in-depth profiles are waiting for you in every episode. Listen to 60 Minutes every Sunday wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back.
Now we're back. We're officially back. Once you hear the boonk. I think this is interesting. I think there is a theme of these two news items that you and I separately picked, and I would just suggest it's a theme of things that are being talked about which really aren't going to actually happen and or make a difference. And I'm happy to explain myself as we get to these items. Mine is this report in Bloomberg today that the Trump administration wants to spend $1 trillion on infrastructure as a way to get this economy going, to which I will only say, oh, my goodness, it's infrastructure
it's
week.
It's infrastructure week.
Again. Look, we desperately need infrastructure in this country. And spend $1 trillion to do it. But that is simply not going to happen.
Apparently, also, since we can spend money with no consequences at this point, there's that. So why not spend it on infrastructure?
Absolutely. I think it's so interesting that this is being trotted out yet again as a thing that is going to save the economy, which really it could do some great good, but I don't actually think it's real. And that's my commentary on the news of the day.
Well, it's funny because here in the wonky world that is Washington, D.C., yes, Infrastructure Week has become this tongue-in-cheek shorthand for mm-hmm. all of these efforts that are announced with big fanfare but don't actually mean anything, or that may or may not be a distraction strategy from mm-hmm. something mm-hmm. happening
for
in the
sure.
news. So it is not uncommon because it is Washington and it is not real America. I know, but you'll be out at a bar. Well, when we went out to bars, you know, someone's like, oh, it's Infrastructure
that's
Week.
Right, that's right. Infrastructure
again.
Week. Yeah, it's crazy. Anyway, so that's my entry in the category of things that just simply just are not going to have a big impact. And now you go with yours and I will explain my prejudging of your item.
Yeah. So today, as we mentioned up top, the Trump administration has this new executive order out, and the president announced it. Their effort to reform the way policing works in America. And the administration says they've been working on this for months and months and months, and this is just a way to incentivize police to engage in best practices. So they're not necessarily saying they're going to penalize police departments for engaging in bad practices, but they're going to tie like grant funding and other things moving forward mm-hmm. to say, I don't know, not allowing their police to put people in chokeholds or to engage in more community policing and to have more partnerships with, say, mental health services. And supposedly this is also going to include an effort to track problem police officers so that they can't, I don't know, engage in police brutality in one place and then mm-hmm. go move to another police department and do the same thing.
Right.
Now, this is my moment to bring up a story I reported a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah,
about the fact that under the Obama administration, there was supposed to be
the database story, right?
This is the FBI database.
Sorry,
there's supposed to be
yeah.
an FBI yeah, yeah. database tracking use of force, and they started collecting data voluntarily from police departments at the beginning of 2019, and they said that they were going to be releasing that data at least twice a year. No data yet. Now, granted, it takes mm-hmm. a while to get this stuff together. New data set. One could make the argument that, you know, they need some time to get it together. But when I pressed the FBI on this, they said that about 40% of police departments, only 40% of officers in America, which basically covers mm-hmm. some of the bigger police departments, but that's wonky numbers. Anyway, only about 40% of officers are submitting data, even tracking whether or not they used force.
Right.
And they said that they were going to release the data, and this is what they said, this summer. But no
right.
more detail than that. So.
Right.
Just
right. So you could have all these executive orders and what have yous until the cows come home. But if people aren't following the rules, and my example here is from like 2 weeks ago, there were protests and there was some violence in Louisville and by the police. And oh, by the way, none of the Louisville police officers who had body cams on had turned their body cams on. Right. I mean, you know, come on, man. That's what I got. And that's why I just, it's my category of news today is stuff that will not actually work to resolve anything.
Although,
yes.
Here's my little dose of
yes.
optimism.
Okay, good.
These initiatives being on the books and the administration, whether it be the Obama administration or the Trump administration, coming out and saying that they're doing this, it does give a space for journalists, the few of us that remain, and community groups and individuals to follow up for accountability, because democracy is not a spectator sport. So if the Trump administration is saying they want more mental health awareness and advocacy and more, and they're tying funding to police departments doing better on these issues, then it gives individuals within communities a tool to hold their police departments to accountability and to, you know, make their decisions about what they're going to do next in terms of their engagement with our democracy.
Yep, totally. 100% agree. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Now, we're moving on to the mailbag, yes?
We are, yes. We, hi, Kai, we are moving.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
So we talked last week about defunding the police, that phrase, what it means, how it's being applied, and where it might take this conversation that we are all having now at a national level about some of these issues. We got to hear Duckett on the phone. He came on to explain it, and we got a bunch of comments on. And here is what Tim Johnson from Mishawaka, Indiana, had to say. Here you go. I will say that I'm pretty new to this phrase, only hearing it for the first time in the past few weeks. At first blush, I was concerned to hear this phrase being coined. However, hearing some of the clarifications being made by activists and city councils has really helped flesh out the idea a little. After taking a step back and trying to listen to all of the points being made about this issue, I completely agree that it's time for steps to be taken at the local and national level to demilitarize and restructure the police in our nation. I do, however, fear that the current ideas of defunding police forces and reallocating responsibilities to social service groups might be a trivialization of what we are really asking for.
Well, I mean, yeah, because, I mean, what at least protesters and activists are asking for is for police to not kill people in general.
Right.
And black people in particular, especially, you know, for things like being drunk and asleep in a car or many of the other traumatic things that have happened. I mean, you and I discussed this in one of our editorial meetings. I, too, was a little bit caught off guard by the defund the police language until I started doing some research into it. And I was just like, oh, yeah, why are the police the ones to respond to mental health crises?
Totally.
And why look, are this they guy responding is just to noise complaints?
Yeah. Right. And to go back to this guy at the Wendy's in Atlanta – who was asleep in his car. Apparently, his sister lived, like, down the road, and he could have walked home. And I don't understand why you couldn't have a social services person, assuming we funded social services at the appropriate level, come to that scene instead of police officers. You know, that's kind of encapsulates the whole thing for me, you know?
It's I'm very interested to see where this conversation goes, because, as you mentioned earlier, a lot of what, you know, of police funding is tied to local communities. And especially in a moment where state and local tax revenues are really strapped because of COVID-19 lockdowns and unemployment and healthcare costs and all these other things, everybody is going to really have to validate their budgets. And so I wonder how this is going to play into those debates.
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure. And look, it is absolutely a conversation to have, for sure. Full stop. Just want to say that.
All right. So last week on the Explain-a-thon. I've never said that word out loud. Explain-a-thon episode. Kai, you took a question about whether or not what we're seeing in the stock market is a moral hazard or a situation where a company might be more inclined to taking on risk because basically they know that we're going to bail them out, we being taxpayers, government, whatever. Anyway, you said that you don't think what's going on is a moral hazard scenario, and listener Eric Nore wanted to respond to that. And here is what he wrote. He said, I have to take issue with the framing of the current stock market rise as not being a product of ongoing moral hazard. Many of the largest U.S. companies collectively engage in share buybacks, leveraged share buybacks, and paying dividends. This occurred during the longest bull market ever and when they were reporting record profits. The fact that companies neglected to have money for the eventual downturn and knew that the feds and society would deem the damage of their negligence too dire to bear is the definition of a moral hazard. It is capitalism on the way up and socialism on the way down. Just like last time, there was a reason these buybacks were considered market manipulation and were illegal for most of the country's history. Is that true, that they were illegal for most of the country's history?
It goes back to the sort of the 80s and when they were permitted and to some degree encouraged by tax policies and all the rest of this stuff. Look, I far be it for me to disagree with the listener, but we will disagree about this specific event. And look, the companies that did these share buybacks, a lot of them have billions of dollars in cash. Cash was not the issue. OK, Cash was not the issue. Anyway, you know.
There was a lot of discussion about companies sitting on this, sitting on these mountains of cash and mm-hmm. taking on all this corporate debt because debt was cheap. I think it is less about companies not having the money and us having to save them. It is about companies choosing not to spend the money they have on these things because they are trying to either preserve shareholder value, and Scott Tong has done this huge thing in the past on shareholder value, mm-hmm. which if people mm-hmm. haven't listened to, they yeah. should. I have to say, I'm more inclined to lean towards the listener perspective here because it comes down to what the responsibility of a company is. And it is mm-hmm. very hard for me to kind of wrap my head around the idea that, yes, you were sitting on all of this cash and you didn't pay your employees anymore, which means that the government basically ended up subsidizing your employees. Many of these companies don't pay that much in taxes. And so that means we as taxpayers are subsidizing their operations. And so I don't know. I think that corporate America is necessary for the full functioning of the U.S. economy. But there are a lot of things that could have been done better to make this crash and this moment we're in not as bad as it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with that. I think that's totally fair. Totally fair.
I know that was all over the place, but my feelings about it are look, all over whole, the place, too.
Yeah, it is a non-simple conversation to have. Okay. Make me smart question before we go. What is something you thought you knew but later found out you were wrong about? Aaron Perry on the biggest question of the moment, literally talking about racism in America. Here you go.
Hi, Kai and Molly. This is Aaron from New Hampshire. One thing I thought I knew, but just found out very recently I was wrong about, is that I thought my children ages 7 and 9 were too young for me to have conversations with them about racism. I always intended on having conversations about race with my children, but I always thought they needed to be older. But then I saw something on social media last week that changed my mind. It said something to the effect of, you don't want to let this moment go by without taking the opportunity to teach your kids about what this moment means. I came to think that if I want to raise boys who are going to be able to recognize racism and speak out against it, how can I expect them to do that if I have not taught them what racism is and how to recognize it? I knew it was going to be a hard conversation. But then I thought about all the mothers of black boys that have to teach their sons at a very young age how to interact with the police. If some mothers have to have those conversations, I owe it to them to teach my children how to recognize racism and what to do when they encounter it. I now understand that they are never too young for these tough conversations, because I am hopeful that they will be the change that I so desperately want to see in the world.
Yeah. Do you remember when your parents or family first started talking to you about racism, Kai?
Oh, yeah, I was six. We were in England. Yeah, you bet. It was late 60s in England, which, you know, first of all, dates me, and oh, my gosh. But I totally remember it. You betcha. 100%.
Yeah, I definitely, I remember I was in, I guess, like the first or second grade, because the school that I went to, they were very fond of like missionary stories. And there were all these stories about missionaries going to the sort of air quotes dark continent and like staining their skin brown and saving the savages type deal. And that led to some really blunt conversations in my family, like with my parents, mm-hmm. when I was like repeating what I was learning in school. And then I think I got called the N-word for the first time that I remember when I was 8. And then around 10, my parents started talking to me about sort of lynchings and police brutality and all that kind of stuff. And then probably not until I was like 12 or 13 did we actually start having the conversations about, here's what you have to do when you're interacting with police. But I remember very clearly, my dad said something to me when I was 12, because I was getting teased a lot at school. And then, because I went to predominantly white school, predominantly black church, and I was getting teased in both places for not fitting in.
Story of my life.
But I was complaining to my dad about this, and he, as a person who has just, he experienced a lot of really terrible and violent racism in his life. He said to me, you have to always remember that you're never going to be black enough for black people. But to white people, the first thing they will always see you as is the N-word. And that was when I was 12.
Honestly, Kimberly, I don't even know what to do with that because it's so far outside my lived experience, you know?
But it's really encouraging to hear people thinking about starting these conversations early. And yeah. I've had conversations with, you know, our colleagues here at Marketplace who mm-hmm. in, you know, appropriate moments have asked them how to start that conversation with their young kids and if I had any resources that I could point them to and are being purposeful mm-hmm. about if they are in primarily, you know, predominantly white environments, going outside of themselves and their own comfort zones to make sure that their kids are exposed. And that's encouraging.
Yeah, that's exactly it. The whole comfort zones thing. Because it's these are such hard conversations to initiate because it's you almost don't know. And look, privileged, middle-aged white guy here. You almost don't know what questions to start asking, if that makes any sense at all. You know? Anyway, that's probably a whole nother episode.
Whew.
Yeah, all shall
right.
we?
I think we're done.
Okay. Yeah. Go ahead. You go.
Oh, all right. So don't forget to sign up for the Make Me Smart newsletter at marketplace.org/newsletters. Back tomorrow with the What Do You Want to Know Wednesday. And Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Sam Anderson. Digital producer is Tony Wagner. Our senior producer is Jody Becker. Thanks to our video producer, Ben Heathcote, who checked out my video beforehand. Thanks, Ben. And our video intern, Ethan Peretz, and our writer-producer, Erica Phillips.
Drew Jostet drove today. Garrett Lang mixed the program. Our theme music was composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez. The executive director of On Demand is Sitar Nieves. The senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark. There you go, guys. Thanks, everybody.
Yeah, this is the most people who've ever been able to see my bedroom, so at least those who are watching on the YouTube video.
No.
It's like, I know I'm opening myself up for all the jokes, had to be
That's
said.
That's all right. It's all good. We want our listeners to know us.
Not that well.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.